Turn to Proverbs 1, verse 32. Tonight, Lord willing, we're going to finish up the first chapter of the book of Proverbs, and we will almost be 1/30th of the way through this Bible study series. Proverbs 1, verse 32. You'll have to pardon my voice and coughing. It says, "For the turning away of the simple shall slay them, and the prosperity of fools shall destroy them." So the Lord here is talking about what's happening to the people that he's been warning here since way up in verse 22. And they didn't pay attention, as you remember, as we went through that, and they turned away. And so this is the consequence: the turning away of the wicked shall slay them. If you remember in verse 23, wisdom had cried to turn you at my reproof, but instead of turning at the reproof, they turned away from it. So I guess they did turn, but they turned the wrong way. And the Lord said in Ezekiel 14:6 to his people to turn away your faces from all your abominations, but instead what they did was turn their ears from the truth. Let's look at that in 1 Timothy 4 and verse 4. 2 Timothy 4 and verse 4. And this really brings it home to us, because this is a warning to Timothy and preaching to his church. And Paul is warning of a time that would come when they wouldn't listen to what he had to say anymore. In verse 2, he says to preach the word, be instant in season, out of season, reprove, rebuke, exhort with all longsuffering and doctrine. For the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but after their own lusts shall they heap to themselves teachers having itching ears, and they shall turn away their ears from the truth, and shall be turned unto fables. And I've seen this very thing happen in a church, and you guys are certainly well aware of that too, where people turn from the doctrine and turn their ears from the truth, and then we're given over to believe all kinds of lies and false doctrine. And that's what's happening here in Proverbs chapter 1. So the Lord says, turning away the simple shall slay them. Now if you turn to Proverbs chapter 3, we see that keeping God's commandments will prolong your life, will add years to your life. And not doing so is going to do the opposite, and I'll show you that in just a second. So Proverbs 3, 1 through 2. It says, "My son, forget not my law, but let thine heart keep my commandments, for length of days and long life and peace shall they add to thee." So keeping God's commandments is a lot better than taking supplements or visiting the doctor regularly or exercising or any of that kind of stuff. All that stuff is fine, but if you want to prolong your life, the best way to do it is by keeping God's commandments, because God promises that long life and peace shall be added unto thee. On the other hand, not keeping God's commandments or turning away from it will shorten one's life. Proverbs 10, verse 27. I'll just give you a couple of examples of that here in a minute. Proverbs 10, 27 says, "The fear of the Lord prolongeth days, but the years of the wicked shall be shortened." Because the wicked don't fear the Lord and they don't keep his commandments. And it says in one of the Psalms that the bloody and deceitful men shall not live out half their days. And I can't remember exactly which psalm that verse is in. But believe it or not, those wicked Pharisees apply that verse to Jesus Christ, because he didn't live out half his days. He died at 33, and they apply that to him, which, of course, is a misinterpretation of that verse.
Pastor Whitney, I've got a question. Yeah. wicked people, reprobate, or does it mean, or are backsliders considered wicked people?
It could be either one. Yeah, it could certainly apply to the reprobate, but even God's own people, like whenever God numerous times sent in heathen nations to destroy them, you know, and his own people died at the hands of their enemies because they didn't keep his word. So yeah, it can apply to wicked people or to righteous people living wickedly.
Of course, you know, it's totally politically incorrect to say this, but AIDS is a definite example of people's life being shortened by disobeying God's
laws.
That's
exactly right. It sure is. The Lord had warned Israel that if they turned away their heart from him, then he would slay them, just like it says there in Proverbs 1:31. Now, if you look in Deuteronomy 30, verses 17 through 19, Deuteronomy 30, 17 through 19, it says, "But if thine heart turn away," remember the turning away, "the wicked shall slay them. But if thine heart turn away, so that thou wilt not hear, but shalt be drawn away and worship other gods and serve them, I denounce unto you this day that ye shall surely perish." Remember, the turning of the way of the wicked shall slay them. "And that ye shall not prolong your days upon the land whither thou passest over Jordan to go to possess it. I call heaven and earth to record this day against you, that I have set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore choose life, that both thou and thy seed may live." So these are God's own people here, and he's saying, you got a choice. You choose life or death, it's up to you. Now, I've actually had people, an Arminian family member of mine, try to use this verse to say that, you know, salvation's all up to you. God says, I set before you life and death, choose life. Like this is some, you know, hey, you can have eternal life or you can go to hell, it's up to you. He's talking to his own blood-bought people here that he bought out of the land of Egypt and his own people that he loved. He's not giving the reprobate some choice to go to heaven or not. He's talking about physical life and physical death dwelling in the land right there in the context. Well, I thought I would just share that with you because maybe someday somebody will throw that one at you like they did to me. That was thrown at me years and years ago before, when I was just first learning the doctrine of grace. There was a king in Israel that didn't heed this warning, and he had to learn his lesson the hard way. His name was Amaziah, and it's recorded in 2 Chronicles 25, and verse 27, just to show you an example of this principle here. It says 2 Chronicles 25, 27, "Now after the time that Amaziah did turn away," remember the turning away of the wicked shall slay them. "Now after the time that Amaziah did turn away from following the Lord, they made a conspiracy against him in Jerusalem, and he fled to Lachish. But they sent to Lachish after him and slew him there." And that is a pretty much word-for-word fulfillment of exactly what God said would happen. They slew him because he turned away from the Lord. And the same thing is, the same warning should be heeded by us, because the scripture warns us in Hebrews 12:25 to not turn away from God that speaks to us in heaven. Hebrews 12, verse 25. Says, Hebrews 12:25, "See that ye refuse not him that speaketh." In other words, if God's speaking to you and you refuse him, what do? Turn away, right? You don't look at him. You don't pay attention to what he's saying anymore. "For if they escape not who refused him that spake on earth, how much more shall not we escape if we turn away," there you go, turn away from him that speaketh from heaven. So these warnings certainly do apply to us. And there'd be plenty of parents out there that could tell you very, very sad stories about their children that they trained up in the way that they should go, and then they turned away. And their turning away ended up slaying them. Like, for instance, being slain by drugs. I know of a parent that happened to. Terribly, terribly sad. One of my mom's best friends, her son died here a couple years ago of a heroin overdose. Really sad. Or alcohol, or drunk driving, or STDs, like Bev just mentioned. Reckless driving. Goodness, I can't tell you how many times I could have died. I mean, it was just within seconds of death, you know, when I was a stupid teenager. Gang violence, suicide, all those things. The turning away of the wicked shall slay them. And it's terribly sad. So fools turn away from God and invite his wrath, but contrarily, in Proverbs 29:18, it says that wise men turn away wrath, right? So you can either turn from God and get wrath, or else you can turn to God and turn away wrath. And that's, of course, what we want to do. We want to follow wisdom. And if we want to avoid the judgment, then just follow Job's example in Job 23:12, where Job said, neither have I gone back, or turned away, in other words, neither have I gone back from the commandment of his lips. I have esteemed the words of his mouth more than my necessary food. That reminds me of a verse. Esteemed the words of God, the words out of his mouth, more than my necessary food. Can anybody think of a verse that reminds you of that? Something that Jesus said one time.
Does not live on bread alone.
Yep. But by every word of God. Yep, that's right. Matthew chapter 4. Okay, let's look at the second part of that verse. Turning away the wicked shall slay them, but the prosperity of fools shall destroy them. So there's two ways here this verse is showing us that people, God's own children, can be destroyed, either from turning away from him or from being made prosperous. And we generally think of prosperity as a blessing, but I'm going to show you tonight that it can be, it doesn't have to be, but it can be a curse on people. And God warned his own people about this, and we'll look at that in just a second. Prosperity is the condition of being prosperous, successful, or thriving, good fortune, success, well-being. So there's nothing wrong with prosperity. I mean, that definition, those are all good things, right? That there's nothing inherently wrong with it. If you notice in the definition, this could be applied to material wealth, right? Success, good fortune, but it doesn't have to be. It could also be in status or in happiness or in health or any number of things where you could be prosperous and you might not be well off money-wise, but you can be prospering. There's a proverb. Let me see. I think it's in Proverbs 13. I really like this one. Proverbs 13:7. There is that maketh himself rich, yet hath nothing. He's rich and wealthy, but he's not prospering. Right? There is that maketh himself poor, yet hath great riches. So you can have great riches and be materially poor. Jesus said to lay up treasures in heaven, where moth and rust doth not corrupt, and where thieves do not break through nor steal. So prosperity in and of itself is not necessarily sinful or harmful. It is true that the wicked are often prosperous. I'll show you a verse that shows you that. And this verse will just confirm what you've seen. Psalm 73. Just by observing the world around you, you will probably notice that probably a good majority of the people out there that are wealthy and prosperous are not godly people. Excuse me. Psalm 73:3-5. The psalmist here, Asaph, says, "For I was envious at the foolish when I saw the prosperity of the wicked." That just doesn't make sense, right? Just why would God let the wicked be prosperous? Why would he let them be well off and successful and thriving and have good fortune? And why would he do that? Well, because they get their portion here, we get our portion in the world to come. Verse 4. For there are no bands in their death, but their strength is firm. Seems like they die with all their family singing hymns around them or something, and they're not struggling, gasping for their last breath or something, and then there's some righteous people that died horrible, painful deaths, and you think, well, why is that the case? Well, it's just the fallen world we live in. Verse 5, they are not in trouble as other men, neither are they plagued like other men. Now this psalmist here, I'm not going to go down through the psalm, but he got his thinking corrected when he went to church. He said, verse 17, until I went into the sanctuary of God, then I understood their end. So it took him going to church to get his thinking straightened out on this. But God also gives prosperity to the righteous, too. And there's a way that every one of us can get that. Look at Joshua 1 and verse 8. And you have all you need to get it right here in front of you, because every one of you have your Bibles in front of you, and right here is all you need to be prosperous and successful in this world. And remember, prosperous and prosperity doesn't necessarily mean money, right? If you pay attention to this book, you can be, if God blesses it, you can be wealthy monetarily too, but that's not what God primarily promises. Joshua 1 and verse 8 says, "This book of the law shall not depart out of thy mouth, but thou shalt meditate therein day and night, that thou mayest observe to do according to all that is written therein, for then shalt thou make thy way prosperous, and then shalt thou shalt have good success. So there's the key to prosperity, is meditating in God's word. And in order to meditate in it, you got to read it, right? Because meditating in it is thinking on it, and musing and considering it. So it's good to read, but it's better to meditate. And I need to hear this as much as anybody else needs to hear it, because everybody knows what it's like sometimes when you're reading the Bible and your mind is somewhere else and you really can't focus on it. And sometimes the best thing to do in that situation is just to pick one verse and just to read it and just think about it. Just think about everything that's contained in that verse. And then that'll draw your mind towards it, into it. And you're not... You ever read a whole paragraph? You actually know that your eyes passed over them and you said the words in your mind, but you were thinking about something totally different, right? And so the key to that is sometimes just picking out one verse and meditating on it. And then the other thing is to humbly seek wisdom, as did Solomon, and then we will be prosperous and successful as well. Now remember, you have to define prosperity as the Bible defines it. You have to define success as the Bible defines it. Because worldly success isn't necessarily what God considers to be success. God considers martyrs that got their heads chopped off to have lived a successful life, and they get a crown of life when they get to heaven. Most people wouldn't consider that success, you know, but if you make it halfway through your life and get your head chopped off, they would probably not say, you know, get up there in your eulogy and say, rattle off all of your accomplishments, right? But let me tell you what, if I got a chance to preach the sermon of a martyr, I would certainly be rattling off the accomplishments, and right there, that is the best accomplishment. First Kings 10 and verse 7. Says, howbeit, I believed not the words until I came and mine eyes had seen it. This is the Queen of Sheba talking to Solomon. And behold, the half was not told me. Thy wisdom and prosperity exceedeth the fame which I heard. And if you remember how Solomon received that prosperity, and in this case, the prosperity was material wealth. And we remember from earlier in this study, and no doubt from reading it yourself, that Solomon, whenever the Lord asked him what he wanted, he didn't ask for wealth, he didn't ask for long life, he didn't ask for the lives of his enemies. He asked for wisdom and an understanding heart to judge God's people. And God gave it to him. And he gave him all those other things as well. Now, prosperity can be a blessing, but you know what? It will actually try the righteous just as much or more as poverty. I can give you a Bible that'll prove this. Proverbs chapter 30. We might think, well, how could prosperity be trying for us? If you have everything you need and life's going great, why would that be a trial? Wouldn't you just thank God for it and be happy and thankful and grateful and da-da-da? No, that's not usually how it works. You might be happy and thankful the first time something good happens, but then after a while, you kind of forget about God sometimes, and that's maybe why God doesn't allow his people to be so prosperous and successful as he does some other people. Proverbs chapter 30, verses 8 through 9. The proverbist, I don't even know if that's a word, but I made it up before, so I guess I'm just referencing a new word now. Proverbs 30, 8 and 9 says, remove far from me vanity and lies. Give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with food convenient for me, lest I be full and deny thee, and say, who is the Lord? Or lest I be poor and steal, and take the name of my God in vain. So either extreme poverty or extreme wealth, could be detrimental to a Christian. Because if you do have everything you need and more, and you're full, then you end up denying the Lord and saying, well, what do I need God for? My hand hath got me this wealth. Right? That's what God said that Israel would say. And I think we may even get to that verse here. It may even be the one that I'm turning to. Deuteronomy chapter 8. Like old King Nebuchadnezzar, right after Daniel told him, interpreted this dream for him, and told him that he was going to end up being cast out into the wilderness until seven times over, and he was going to be crawling around like a beast. And it didn't take Nebuchadnezzar long before he's walking through his kingdom and looking at all, and he says, look at this great kingdom that I have builded. And right there, his understanding departed from him, and he went out to the field, and his hair grew like bird's feathers, and his fingernails grew out like bird's claws, and he crawled around and ate grass like an ox. Right there, just because he said, look at this great kingdom I have builded, he didn't realize where the prosperity came from. Look at Deuteronomy chapter 8, 11 through 20. And if you never end up being rich in this world, there may be a reason for that. And if I never end up rich in this world, there may be a reason for that. And the reason might be because it would ruin me. And it would ruin you. And maybe God doesn't want us to be ruined. So that could be. I don't know.
What do you clarify as rich?
Money-wise?
No, I mean, that's the thing, is we may never be monetarily rich, but we could be rich in so many other things.
Oh, yeah. And I was referring to monetarily. Yeah.
I think almost any verse that refers to being wealthy, poor, and the connections with it pretty much can be applied to both spiritual and physical wealth in almost every one.
Yeah, in many aspects, certainly. Sometimes it's definitely talking about money, but mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and that, like that proverb said, you know, you can make yourself poor and yet have great riches. Mm-hmm. You know, so there is spiritual riches that won't destroy you, obviously, but the monetary stuff sometimes will, and I'm sure we've probably known people that's happened to, or at least heard of people that's happened to. Deuteronomy 8, 11 through 20. I thought you were asking how much money is rich. I was going to say, I'd say probably a couple million. I don't know. That's rich, I think. I don't know. If you got less than that, you could blow it on a nice house, right? So I don't know if I'd say you're rich if you got less than that. But anyway, Deuteronomy 8, 11 through 20. It says, beware that thou forget not the Lord thy God in keeping his commandments and his judgments and his statutes, which I command thee this day. Let me just point out something to you. He says, beware that thou forget not the Lord thy God. And how do you forget him? In not keeping his commandments, right? Well, I haven't forgot the Lord. Well, but, you know, if you haven't kept his commandments, you've actually forgotten him, because God considers his book, right? His book, his word is elevated above his very name. So if we forget the commandments, we've actually forgotten the Lord. Verse 12, lest when thou hast eaten and art full, and hast built goodly houses, and dwelt therein, and when thy herds and thy flocks multiply, so they've got a really nice house, their business is going well, they've got flocks and herds and all this stuff, and thy silver and thy gold are multiplied, so they've got money, and all that thou hast is multiplied, when thine heart be lifted, then thine heart be lifted up, and thou forget the Lord thy God, which brought thee forth out of the land of Egypt, from the house of bondage, who led thee through that great and terrible wilderness, wherein were fiery serpents and scorpions and drought, where there was no water, who brought thee forth water out of the rock of flint, who fed thee in the wilderness with manna, which thy fathers knew not, that he might humble thee, and that he might prove thee to do thee good in at thy latter end. And thou say in thine heart, and this is the verse that I was referring to a second ago, and thou say in thine heart, my power and my might and the might of my hand hath gotten me this wealth. See, when the Lord gave them all that, and then they turn around, they don't credit God for it. They say, I worked hard for this. I got this. Right? What they don't realize is that promotion comes from the Lord. Even if you did work hard and you did get promoted, it still came from the Lord. And if you forget that, God will show you where it came from, and he will show you that it's going to depart quickly.
You can't even work hard lest God allow you to take a breath in the morning.
That's right. Absolutely. But thou shalt remember the Lord thy God, for it is he that giveth thee power to get wealth, that he may establish his covenant, which he sware unto thy fathers, as it is this day. And it shall be, if thou do at all forget the Lord thy God, and walk after other gods, and serve them, and worship them, I testify against you this day, that ye shall surely perish. This puts the two clauses of that proverb together, the turning away of the simple shall slay them, and the prosperity of fools shall destroy them, right? The turning away and the prosperity are tied together in this passage, both of which causing destruction. As the nations which the Lord destroyeth before your face, so shall ye perish, because ye would not be obedient unto the voice of the Lord your God. That's why I say that prosperity can be just as dangerous to a Christian as poverty can, and sometimes even worse, probably more times than not worse. I think affluence is a greater temptation than poverty is to most people, I would think. Because look at this country. Look at what's happened to this country. This country is affluent, right? This country has a lot of wealth, and has had for a long time. And what has happened to us? We've turned away. We've forgotten the Lord. And then you look at other poorer countries, and in some cases, they haven't, right? And they're more humble than we are, and they're relying on the Lord. So I don't know. Maybe we have hard times coming because we need it.
Well, just as many wealthy people die of drug overdoses and things like that as poor people, and I don't know about the suicide rates, but you hear plenty of wealthy, powerful, famous, et cetera, et cetera, that kill themselves.
That's true. I know white men kill themselves proportionally more than anybody else.
Isn't it Japanese and South Koreans? In the
U.S., anyway. Yeah, there's a really high suicide rate in Japan. Part of that because there's such pressure on them to succeed and to succeed in schooling and education, and if they don't measure up to that, then a lot of them kill themselves. It's very sad. But you're right. There's a huge heroin opioid epidemic in suburbia, not in the ghettos. I mean, maybe it's there too in the United States.
Yeah.
It's bad. So in poverty we turn to the Lord, in prosperity we often turn from Him. It takes a very wise and a strong man to be able to handle wealth and success. Look at Proverbs 11 and verse 16. And there's two reasons for that, and I'll give those to you in just a second. Proverbs 11:16. It says, a gracious woman retaineth honor, and strong men retain riches. So what does that tell us? If strong men retain riches, what does that tell you? You have to be to retain it, you have to be strong. And if you're not a strong man, what's that imply is going to happen? You're not going to retain it, right? The riches are going to
evaporate.
Yep, fall right through your fingers. So there's two ways that can happen. Either excessive wealth would be too much for the weak man to handle, and he'll blow it like a drunken sailor, or he'll end up being puffed up with pride by it. So either way, he'll lose it through foolishness, or else, even worse, he'll become proud because of it. And in either one of those things is not good. It's like the psalmist said, and I'm sure that we can probably identify with this. We said in Psalm 30 and verse 6, in my prosperity I said, I shall never be moved. Right, when we're prosperous and things are going well, we feel like we're on top of the world. Nothing's ever going to happen to me. I got this great job security. Everything's wonderful. Got a great family, got a great whatever. You know, my 401k has got tons of money in it. I'm set for the future. Nothing's going to happen. I mean, what could possibly change this? Oh, anything. I mean, any number of things could change it in a heartbeat.
This too shall pass.
Yeah, that's right. It says riches make themselves wings and fly away as an eagle toward heaven. So I'd say being made proud by wealth is a bigger failure than being made poor by it. And you're thinking, how could you be made poor by wealth? I'm going to show you here in just a second. You probably heard about people winning the lottery or getting some huge inheritance. And for the average dolt, stupid person, that's going to be more of a curse than a blessing. And that's ubiquitous. Right. I mean, I don't. It'd be interesting to see a study, and I didn't bother to look it up if there is such a thing. But of the percentage of people that win the lottery that are not broke within 2, 3, 4, or 5 years afterwards, and if I just had to take a swag at it, you know what swag stands for? Okay, I'm not going to tell you because it's not. not suitable language for a Bible study, but anyway.
I guess I don't know what that
is. Okay. It's a scientific wild something guess.
Oh.
So, anyway, I would say 75% would be my guess of people that win the lottery that are dead broke in a few years. And probably part of that is because of the type of people that play the lottery. You know, not everybody that plays the lottery is a dirtbag, but you ever go into like some of these gas stations around here and you see people that clearly probably don't have a job or don't have much of one if they do, and what are they buying? On top of their $5 in gas so they can get, you know, through the next day, what are they buying? Lottery tickets, cigarettes, beer, snuff, whatever. I just see them. I mean, just spending crazy. Every time I go to the gas station, it seems, that little one at Walmart, there's, yeah, give me 5 of those, give me 10 of those, and idiots. But anyway, so that might be part of the reason, because the types of guys that play the lottery, you know, if they do win, are going to blow it all, but anyway.
But sports figures, look how many of them wind up poor.
Yeah.
And, right. You know, for 10 years, they're making millions.
Huge, yeah.
Between their sports and their...
advertising.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And they wind up poor.
A lot of them do.
Dead broke.
And a lot of Hollywood celebrities and singers. Part of that with the singers, I think, is that the labels get so much of the money that the singers, it looks like they're really wealthy, but they don't hardly get any of it, is what I've read. But anyway, you always hear these stories about people winning the lottery and being broke. Well, this is absolutely biblical. Look in Proverbs 13:11. Proverbs 13:11 says, "Wealth gotten by vanity shall be diminished, but he that gathereth by labor shall increase." Mm-hmm. Well, that wealth gotten by vanity would be a definition of the lottery. Vanity by nothing, basically, right? It's handed to you.
Okay.
And it's diminished. But if you labor and work for it, then you'll be increased. That's why it doesn't almost ever work that if you are wealthy, to give your kids a great big inheritance, or especially when they're younger or something. And it, maybe not in every case, but I would think in most cases, they're just going to blow it because they didn't work for it and they have no idea how wealth is generated.
Families that retain wealth have it tied up in so that they can't get the actual wealth. They can only get the...
yeah.
Interest.
Put it in a trust or something. And
right.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the way to do it. I think, I'm no fan of Bill Gates or Warren Buffett, but those guys, they're going to leave the vast majority of their wealth to some charitable organization, which I'm sure is some horrible thing anyway. But and they're going to leave a relatively small amount to their kids, like 10 million or something. Which I mean, but for those guys, I mean, that's nothing. That's yeah. Literally pennies.
Yeah.
You know, that'd be like you leaving pennies to your kid. But yeah, I think like 99% of their wealth are going to give away or something. Which unfortunately, that's going to be a waste of. Of money too. They made all these great products to enrich everybody's life and then get profit thereby, which they deserve, and then just turn around and give that to a bunch of wicked organizations that are going to use it to do who knows what. But
one of the things Warren Buffett's wife does is she has worked in Nebraska to get preschools down to 2 years and younger.
Oh, isn't that wonderful?
Really? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they call it pennies for something or something pennies.
Yeah.
And Broken Bow was so thrilled. They were one of the first communities in the state to get that money to get two-year-olds into the school system.
Well, why don't they just start it at like 3 days old? That way you don't ever have to parent your kids at all. You can give them to the state and they can take care of it for you.
They'll get their pastor.
Yeah.
You know,
it's coming.
And that wealth by vanity, I've been told before that most, I don't know if you call it economists or what, but people that are in the know on such things say that if you actually did, like, just take all the money in the United States and just level it with everybody take, so everybody goes up or down, everybody in the United States has the same amount of money, the people that are rich now will be rich again in a few years.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yep. That's absolutely
because
right.
Because the thing is, the people that are poor because they know how to spend money. The people who are rich because they know how to save money.
And invest
it. And that is not going to change.
Yep,
so
that's
you
right.
Take and level it all, it'll all go back to the same way it was.
That's exactly right. And poor people and rich people think differently. And mm-hmm. poor people just tend to think that the rich just got lucky or something. And there is the average guy that got it, you know, inherited it or something. But I would say the vast majority of rich people did not get that way by accident. Yeah. They got that way by blood, sweat, and tears, and acumen, and wisdom, and hard work.
Good investments.
Yeah, absolutely. Proverbs 20 and verse 21. It says, an inheritance may be gotten hastily at the beginning, but the end thereof shall not be blessed. So it goes for lottery proceeds or for an inheritance. That's, you get it quickly, and you lose it just about as quickly. Now, most people, I think, would respond to this and say, I know the rest of those idiots would do that, but not me. If I won the lottery, I'd be good. I'd save it. I'd invest it. I'd be set. I mean, not me. I know those other idiots. No way. I'll just ask you some questions here. And this might not be absolutely sure, but I'd say the answers to these questions would let you know if winning the lottery would help you out or wouldn't help you out at all. Do I spend more than I... do I spend more when I make more? So if you get a raise, do you spend more as you make more or not? Do I save no matter what my income? So, you know, if your income goes down by 30%, do you still save money, or you say, well, I can't afford to save money now? Do I save more than I did 5, 10, 20 years ago, depending on how old you are, when I made less? Or do I save the same amount now as I did then and spend the extra? And I'm sure the answer with most people is, yeah, I save the same amount that I always have. Nothing, right? That, I mean, the average American is within one flat tire away from bankruptcy, and that is not even an exaggeration. The majority of people don't have $500 for a rainy day fund, which is insane, but that's the way it is. When I get a raise, do I save the extra after giving to the Lord, or do I just adjust my standard of living to meet my new higher salary? And I don't know what the percentages are, but most people, they spend whatever they make, right? If you're making 50 grand a year, you live on 50 grand a year. If you make 100 grand a year, you live on 100 grand a year. I mean, you spend everything you make. That's what most people do. Has my standard of living risen proportionally to my income over time, which is just another way of saying the same thing. Now, I'd say that people's answers to these questions would be a good indicator of whether prosperity would destroy you or, you know, or help you out. So winning the lottery or inheriting money, if you basically spend whatever you get, no matter what that amount is, then chances are, if that amount happened to be $1 million, you'd blow right through it, right? Now, if you, as you get raises, you keep putting more and more away, then if you get $1 million, well, I'd say a guy like that, he might actually, you know, save that and not spend it. So to sum this up, if a man spends more when he makes more, or saves the same amount now as he did years ago when he made far less, and adjusts his standard of living to match his salary as it increases, then he can assume with reasonable certainty that because he spends every extra dime he makes, a significant increase in his wealth and prosperity would be of no real benefit to him and would likely be a curse that would destroy him. And I mean, I'm sure you know, maybe you've said it yourself or you've heard people say it, if I just made $1,000 a month more, I'd be set. Everything would be great. I wouldn't have anything to worry about. And I would venture to guess that if that person made $1,000 a month more, within not too much time, he'd be saying the same exact thing, because what did he do? He just went out and bought more stuff, got more loans, got more, you know, and he's in the same exact place as he was before. If I made what those congressmen make in Washington, D.C., I'd be good. You give me 161 grand a year, I'd be living the high life. Actually, they wouldn't say that. I'd be putting it away, and I'd be retired in 10 years. No, I doubt it. So I'd say if, you know, such a man should actually thank God for not materially prospering him, because if God did so, he would end up destroying him. I think about my own situation. Before I went into the ministry, as I made more money, I just saved more money. Like, I never really changed my standard of living. And my friends all lived in places that cost two or three times what I lived in and drove cars that were, you know, many, many times more expensive than mine. But I never changed the way I lived. And then I'm thankful that I did that, because when it came time to go into the ministry and take a huge pay cut, I basically could live about the same as I always lived. And I didn't really have to change anything, except that I just wasn't able to save very much money or no money at some points. But anyway, I was able to do it. But if I, and this is one thing I'd recommend if I ever looked at a man to ordain him, I would look at, is he good with money? Is he frugal? Because if he's not, in this job, you're self-employed, right? And I have to set money aside every time I get paid to pay the government at the end of the year, right? And you can imagine what the average American would do if he didn't have withholdings tax, and at the end of the year, he had to write Uncle Sam a big old fat check. Well, I guess the good thing would be that we wouldn't have such high income tax rates, because nobody would pay it, because nobody would have the money. But, you know, if somebody's going to be self-employed, or you're going to be in the ministry, you got to be financially responsible. You got to be putting money away to pay Uncle Sam. And, you know, if I would have lived way out of my means, then what would I have done? I had to go full-time engineering job when I first went into the ministry. And a lot of the stuff that I did for the last 5 or 6 years would have never gotten done, because I just wouldn't have had the time to do it. So anyway, I'm glad that the Lord gave me that wisdom and sense to live like that during the years of prosperity. Proverbs 1:33, the last verse here in Proverbs. It says, "But whoso hearkeneth unto me shall dwell safely and shall be quiet from fear of evil." So this is, we're finally down to the end after, I think it's 15 studies on Proverbs chapter 1. I am going to try to move through this book a little more quickly in the future. I saw with you, I can read lips. She said, sure. I really am. I it's hard for me because I have, well, you know, because I've written the books on the first two chapters or two and a half. And so I'm reading back through that stuff. And I've got so much stuff in there, and it's just hard to cut things out. Like, well, I don't want to not say, oh, that's a good point. I don't want to, you know. When I finally get to the actual Proverbs themselves, then I'm going to, well, even before that, I'm going to try to start moving along a little faster. I would like to get through this thing before I'm, you know, in the grave or something. Okay, so verse 33. "But whosoever hearkeneth unto me shall dwell safely and shall be quiet from fear of evil." So here the Lord concludes his rebuke and his warning of the simple who would not hear the word with an encouragement to those who will. See, the Lord finally, now he's done talking about the people that wouldn't listen to him anymore and the people that are, you know, have been judged and in trouble. And now he gives us some reassurance here. You people that have read this and are not following in the path of these types here, here's what you have waiting for you: dwelling safely and being quiet from fear of evil. So the last words here are not addressed to the prating fools that fell, but to the wise in heart that receive commandments. Proverbs 10 and verse 8. And you'll see why I worded it that way as we read this verse. Proverbs 10 and verse 8. It says, "The wise in heart will receive commandments, but a prating fool shall fall." And this sums up the Proverbs chapter 1, prating fools. You know, they wouldn't listen, they wouldn't hearken, and so they fell. But the wise that receive the commandments, peace and safety are awaiting them. You see, the wise are going to look and see the judgment of the fools, and they're going to take wisdom from that. And they don't have to actually fall themselves and go through what the fools went through to learn from it. Proverbs 19 and verse 25. "Smite a scorner, and the simple will beware. Reprove one that hath understanding, and he will understand knowledge." And then Proverbs 21 and verse 11 says, "When the scorner is punished, the simple is made wise. And when the wise is instructed, he receiveth knowledge." So there's probably, I guess, three kinds of people. There are wise people that learn from other people's mistakes, and then there are people that are maybe not quite so wise but are still wise that learn from their own mistakes, and then there's just dummies that don't learn from their own or anybody else's for that matter, and they just continually repeat the same stuff. He says, "But whoso hearkeneth unto me shall dwell safely." So safety is one of the most cherished human needs, if you think about it. And I think we probably don't think about safety all that much because we live in a pretty safe place. You know, pretty safe country, pretty safe community here. And honestly, safety is not on my mind all that often. But I'm sure there are plenty of people in this world that safety, I mean, like my wife.
Yes, that's why I lock the doors.
Yeah, because she grew up in a place that wasn't as safe. And it wasn't safe. And
even at Walmart, I'm like, I just held on to my bag tightly because in the Philippines, even when we're in a shopping mall, someone could grab it.
Yeah. Run. Yeah. Yeah, she was actually accosted by some teenage boys a few years ago in the Philippines on her way to work.
20 of them.
Yeah.
Wow.
I think so.
Yeah, they stole stuff from her. And
ice pick instead of a knife. Is that right? Ice pick?
Yeah. Yep, so when you grow up in a place like that, you're more wary of things. When I was there, I wasn't afraid of anything, but maybe I should have been. But she was all concerned that, because I was taking my phone out and taking pictures and all that. And I was, I was American, and she's like, "Oh, put your phone away, don't take it out." I'm like, "Oh, don't worry about it." So, anyway. But the thing is, with an unsafe place or a situation, it breeds fear, which is tormenting. 1 John 4 and verse 18. The verse tells us that perfect love casteth out fear. 1 John 4:18. There is no fear in love, but perfect love casteth out fear, because fear hath torment. He that feareth is not made perfect in love. And everybody knows that. If you're afraid, it's very tormenting. You can imagine if every night in your house, you were just worrying if tonight's going to be the night that somebody breaks in and tries to harm me or rob me or something like that, or you're afraid that a tornado is going to blow over your house, or if you live in a foreign country, you're afraid that a drone's going to blow you up or something. I mean, that would not be a fun place to be. Safely is defined as without harm or injury occasioned or received. So when the Lord says that whoso hearkeneth unto me shall dwell safely, he shall dwell without harm or injury. So he doesn't have to be concerned about that. And I would say that the most valuable and sought-after commodity of safety would not be acquired by purchasing a gun or getting a home security system or something like that, but simply by listening to God's words, by hearkening unto wisdom's cry. And that's where we can be guaranteed safety. Because a lot of that other stuff, I think it's good to make preparation. But sometimes if you make too much preparation and you end up relying on that stuff, that actually feeds into fear. It's weird, but you know, people that have all their doors reinforced and they check their locks at night before they go to bed, and they've got security cameras all over the place and they're monitoring, and no matter where they are in their house, they can see these, you know, the cameras on the outside. That probably doesn't breed stability and security. It breeds fear and insecurity. So the best thing to do is just to pay attention to what God says and make reasonable provision. If a Christian struggles with fear and feelings of insecurity, the antidote to that torment is, as it says in Proverbs 3:21 through 26, to keep sound wisdom and discretion by reading God's word and by trusting in him and allowing him to take you through this world safely without fear. Proverbs 3:21 through 26. It says, "My son, let them not depart from thine eyes." This is the Lord's commandments. "Keep sound wisdom and discretion. They shall be life unto thy soul and grace to thy neck. Then shalt thou walk in thy way safely, and thy foot shall not stumble. When thou liest down, thou shalt not be afraid." You're not going to be afraid to go to sleep. "Yea, thou shalt lie down, and thy sleep shall be sweet. Be not afraid of sudden fear, neither of the desolation of the wicked when it cometh, for the Lord shall be thy confidence, and shall keep thy foot from being taken. The antidote to fear is faith. At what time I'm afraid, I will trust in thee, David said in the Psalms. Now, here's the other side that you want to remember, and that is the promise of dwelling safely isn't a guarantee that trouble will never come. So it's not like, oh, I read my Bible every day, nothing bad's ever going to happen. That's not the case. As a matter of fact, probably the more you read that Bible, the more trouble you will have. The closer you get to God, the more, in some ways, the more trouble you're going to have. Solomon said, you can turn to John 16:33. Solomon said that in much wisdom is much grief, and he that increaseth knowledge increaseth sorrow. So the more you learn, the more God requires of you. You know, he that knew, to whom much is given, much is required, the Lord said. And the man that knows and doesn't do gets beat with many stripes, and the man that doesn't know, he gets beat with few. Anyways, John 16 and verse 33. Jesus said, these things I have spoken unto you, that in me ye might have peace. In the world ye shall have tribulation, but be of good cheer, I have overcome the world. So you see, at the same time you can have peace in tribulation, you can have peace while going through tribulation. So it's not all just, you know, a bed of roses for a Christian. Things will get tough, but we can still have peace through it. The Lord will, just like he did for Israel, will bring us through our trouble. It says in Psalm 78:53 that he led them on safely so that they feared not, but the sea overwhelmed their enemies. So just like he led them through safely, through the Red Sea, he'll do so to us too. Now the other thing is, in addition to safety, is quietness. Quietness from fear of evil. And this is probably, or at least it should be, one of the deepest desires of a Christian, is to live a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and honesty. Look at 1 Timothy 2 and verse 2. This is why I truly don't go looking for trouble at this point in my life. There was a time in my life, a time in my conversion, where I definitely did go looking for trouble. I mean, looking for controversy, looking for debate. And even though I said I didn't, I mean, I probably really was. I mean, I don't go looking for it anymore. Sometimes it comes to you and you have to deal with it. But usually now I just don't have enough time. If it comes off the internet and the person is of no, they're just some guy out there, I just don't bother. If it's somebody that I have to deal with it with, if it's a church member or it's, you know, something like that, anyway, then I have to. But if I don't have to, I don't bother with it. 1 Timothy 2 and verse 2. He says, I exhort therefore that first of all supplications, prayers, intercessions, and giving of thanks be made for all men, for kings, and for all that are in authority, that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and honesty. And I need to do this more often, but when we pray for our president or our leaders and all that, I don't necessarily pray for good government, or I pray that things will be turned around, or that the budget's going to be balanced, or, you know, that whatever, gay marriage is going to be overruled and all. I think we're under God's judgment, and if the Lord would spare us for a time, that'd be great. But the main thing that I would pray with regards to them is that they'll just leave us alone, that I could live a quiet and a peaceable life in all godliness and honesty. Because, and I think that's something we all should pray for, because you're in this day and age, your life can be turned upside down in a heartbeat. Just one government bureaucrat somehow gets a hold of your name about anything. You dug a ditch out here or something and destroyed a wetland or something. And literally, I'm serious. I mean, your entire life can be ruined.
Bundies.
Yeah, right. It is a good thing to pray that we would live a quiet and peaceable life, that they will just leave us alone and we can fly under the radar. Quiet is defined as free from disturbance, molestation, or annoyance, not interfered or meddled with, left in peace, of a state, condition, procedure, etc. It's in the phrase, anything for a quiet life. Now, I don't know about you, but I just reading that definition makes me feel good. It just kind of brings a calmness over me just reading the definition. And it's funny, I'm sure to little kids, just that idea, free from disturbance or annoyance or not interfered, left in peace and all that, that would be no consolation to them whatsoever. That is boring, right? But not to adults, or at least it shouldn't be. If your idea of a good life is a life of disturbance and fighting all the time, that you get some problems. So the one simple step necessary for reaching this goal of a quiet life, free from disturbance and full of peace, is the same that ensured safe dwelling, and that is hearkening unto wisdom. We should be reading the scriptures and studying to be quiet. So this is something that we actually have to learn. 1 Thessalonians 4 and verse 11. If you have to study to do something, right? I mean, you got to study to learn how to do math or to do science or to learn how to do some skill or trade or something like that. Well, that tells me that if you had to study to be quiet, it's something that doesn't come naturally, and it's something you got to put effort into. 1 Thessalonians 4 and verse 11. Paul here exhorts this church, and that ye study to be quiet and to do your own business, right? Good old mind your own business. There's this guy out there on Route 10. I don't know if you probably don't go that way. You go that way towards Richmond. You know those crazy people out there? They got the fence that go around their yard and all this junk in their yard, but they're not just pigs because they move the junk around. And it's the weirdest thing.
They have all these signs.
And the other day they had this great big sign. And I don't know, maybe they're trying to signal to people about themselves or something. But great big sign that says, mind your business. I mean, this thing's like 15 feet long or something. And I don't know if they're telling passerbys to mind their business or telling the government to mind their... I don't know what they're doing. But anyway, it's just constant. There's something different. They got a big American flag hanging up. They used to have some Shrek poster hanging up on their house. Bizarre.
You seen those people?
I've seen them outside mowing the grass.
I saw them today.
They look a little different.
A lot.
Yeah. Anyway, where was I going with that? Mind your own business. Yeah, yeah. So anyway, the Bible teaches us what those nice folks were trying to teach us with their billboard in their yard, to do your own business and to work with your own hands as we commanded you, that ye may walk honestly toward them that are without, and that ye may have lack of nothing. So we are to study to be quiet. So we got to work on it. I know people in my life that just have a very tumultuous life, and it just wouldn't be for me. I don't like that kind of stuff. And there's just always something. There's always some controversy, some of which is brought upon themselves, some of which it just seems like for whatever reason... I don't think they just attract it, or just stuff happens. Like, he's driving through the parking lot and some dude backs into him and tears his entire rear bumper off. And then the guy supposedly didn't have his insurance card with him, and he got his information, and the guy offered to fix it himself and blah, blah, blah. And then he goes and gets the car looked at, and it turns out that there was way more damage than it looked like, and there was like $10,000 worth of damage on this car, and then he can't get a hold of the guy. Of course, and you know, the guy, you know, so anyway, it's just stuff like this, where some of the stuff's clearly brought upon yourself, and then there's other stuff where you're just driving along and crash, some guy runs into you, but it just seems like stuff like that happens all the time. Certain people are just magnets for it. That's not for me, though. Quiet and peaceable life as much as possible. And when we learn how to live righteously by keeping God's commandments, that will result in a quiet in peace and quietness. Isaiah 32, verses 17 through 18. This verse is another one that just brings a calming effect over me. Isaiah 32, 17 through 18. It says, "And the work of righteousness shall be peace, and the effect of righteousness, quietness and assurance forever. And my people shall dwell in a peaceable habitation, in sure dwellings, and in quiet resting places." So when we work righteousness and we keep God's commandments and do what he says, the effect of that ends up being peace and quietness and assurance. Let me give you one more. Turn to Job 34 and verse 29. If we do this, then we can be assured that it's not going to be easily, our quiet life's not going to be easily overthrown because the Lord's going to preserve it. Job 34 and verse 29 says, "When he giveth quietness, who can make trouble? And when he hideth his face, who then can behold him, whether it be done against a nation or against a man only?" So whether it's a nation or a man, when God gives quietness, nobody's going to make trouble. And God gives quietness to people who study to be quiet and to be righteous and to keep his commandments and to hearken to the things that he said and to turn when God tells them to turn, just like we've been reading there in Proverbs chapter 1. And that finishes up Proverbs chapter 1. So next time, Lord willing, we will start into Proverbs chapter 2.